Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we are joined today by Julia Steiner.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I am doing well. I'm excited to be here. There's coffee. There's some cats in jail right now. And
they're in jail.
They are in cat jail.
It was a preemptive strike. They were being total buttheads.
Theirs was a preemptive strike, or us putting them in cat jail was a preemptive strike?
I think both. Yeah. I think they kind of like got their jollies out before we started recording, and then I, acting preemptively, was like, fuck this. No.
My dad would always make fun of my grandma for believing that she could talk to animals, or like believing that animals are smarter than they are. And I'm not going to get into the nuances of the social structure there, but I will say that I very much believe that, like, the cats know what they're doing. Like, they know, because we hadn't even sat down for maybe a minute before Moody first started making noises, and then Oscar was like, all right, well, I'm going to fucking make noises too. And they're not entirely noisy cats all the time, but now to a T, they know when we're recording.
Yeah.
And they know, like, I should not be making noises, but I'm going to, because then somebody's going to pick me up.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and then as soon as I take my headphones off, Moody hides.
Yeah.
And, like, as soon as I, like, get out of my chair and head toward her, she hides. I'm like, well, then don't do that.
Yeah. We could have all lived happily.
Yeah, like, but you had to make an ass of yourself.
You made a choice.
Yeah.
You made a choice, Moody.
That's the thing with me with the cats, is the ideal situation is, while this is happening, that they are in our laps and slowly going from lap to lap, and, like, that would be great.
It would be.
And I think they also want that.
And there have been interviews where that's happened, where, like, Moody will just, like, camp out on someone's lap, and then she'll get skeeved out by something, and she'll dash away.
Yeah.
But, you know, the first part of it where she's just, like, kind of passed out on someone's lap is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a really, everyone likes it.
Mm-hmm.
We could have had it all.
Really, though. Really, though. We, so Julia, now it's 10. We had a slow start this morning. We're all sipping coffee. Julia was over for Sunday dinner last night.
I was.
And we were listening to Adele last night.
Mm-hmm.
So you made me think of that when you quoted it. That's all I've got to say, really.
Yeah. So we had a slow start, but we're gonna talk about good thing. I'm excited about talking to you, Julia. First of all, I've known you since I was 4. I feel like half of the people we interview are like, I've known you since I was a child. Mm-hmm. But like,
but I win. I've known you the longest.
No, I've known you since I was like 4 or 5. We went to the same church growing up. And we both, we bonded over having a deep appreciation for the donuts after church.
Oh my God.
Like the we would jelly, like, church would
ride
end
or die.
Yeah. No, I always got the cream filled.
I would fight someone for a jelly donut.
Yeah. But we would, like, church would end, it'd be like, amen, and Julie and I would, like, make eye contact and dash out to the donuts.
Were you guys in the choir?
Yes, yeah, we were.
And we thoroughly made fun of it the entire time. It was great. Yeah. And it's been pretty much consistently that.
Yeah. Consistent levels of snark. Yeah.
Donuts and snark.
Yeah. And Pokemon/Team Rocket appreciation.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. So Julie and I have a very long history. And she's... I've always been interested in the path you've pursued, because it's always been a little different from mine, but, like, I've always been very interested in it. And here's why. So I went to, like, I was, like, public school through and through. You went to, like, an alternative education elementary and middle school.
I absolutely did. It is called, shout out to Woodland School in Milwaukee, by the way. I grow to appreciate them more and more as I get older. I think at the time I was all, this is weird. Why don't I have normal letter grades like the other children? But now I really appreciate how diverse the school was and how I was just surrounded by kids from some from the same background, most from different backgrounds than me, and it's definitely helped me come up in the world. And
then you went from there to an all-girls Catholic high school.
Yeah, that was the thing that happened.
And then you went to a liberal arts university in northern Wisconsin called Lawrence, where I like how I'm like telling your story to you, but I'm enjoying it.
I'm here for it.
Where you double majored in poli sci and vocal performance.
So the story behind that is when I was 17, I had made it abundantly clear that I wanted to study music in college, and my parents were like, that's great, we love the arts, we want to support your dream, but you gotta major in something else.
So poli sci.
And I was actually French for a little while.
Cool.
And then Barack Obama got elected, and I became utterly obsessed with that campaign and the day-to-day nuances and craziness of the news cycle, and it was all very, very addictive, and I had always loved, you know, AP Gov in high school and all of the political history stuff that I learned in various history classes as a youngster, and I wanted to learn more, so I went that route. Mm-hmm. And cool. Lawrence is two schools. It's technically a university because there's a conservatory of music and then there's the College of Liberal Arts, and they're separated by the main street in Appleton, College Avenue, and so I always felt like I had one foot on one side of the Ave and one foot on the other side of the Ave. It was a very treacherous crossing. Lots of cyclists got hit.
Oh my god, really?
So I was putting my life in my hands every day.
Just how far north was it?
And it's about 30 minutes south of Green Bay.
Okay. Yeah, no, we were talking to Catherine Duffy last night. Shout out Catherine Duffy about Door County.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's such a cool and interesting thing because it's very similar to, like, I don't know if there are a ton of Long Islanders here, but I feel like there are Long Islanders that I know that are like Josh and Tyler that may not have been to Door County, but it's very similar to like Sag Harbor and Montauk. And so now I feel like I've completely excluded anyone that's not from Wisconsin or Long Island, but
I
here we are.
I can include Massachusetts in here. Door County is kind of like Cape Cod, but with a lake.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really cool. And so that is, cause Green Bay, this is podcast gold. I'm trying to do the peninsula of Door County with my hands. Like, so here's Wisconsin, and then here's Door County.
Well, for
and then so Green Bay's here.
Everybody,
right?
Listeners at home,
take out your hand.
Take out your hand. Yeah. Take out your left hand, and put your fingers together. But then kind of like extend your thumb like a hitchhiker thumb. That's what Wisconsin looks like. Door County's your thumb.
Yeah. Yeah, which is cool because there's something that happens to a community that's isolated like that, like geographically isolated, and it just becomes like, I don't know, there's like four or five different theater companies in Door County and like music festivals and stuff, and
and
like really good apple pie,
but also cherries
and cherries,
yeah, that's what it's famous for.
Tangent life.
Shout out to Door County.
Yes.
It's magic.
Yes.
Go
This is going to be an episode of shout outs, just so you know. So, moving on. You decided ultimately, in terms of your education, to pursue music.
I did. So the thing I did was a 5-year double degree program, which means that I finished with a Bachelor of Music and a Bachelor of Arts.
Mm.
And I was getting to, you know, my fourth year, time to decide what my next steps were. And I ultimately decided to apply for grad school in music because I feel like if you're an opera singer, there's a lot of biological pressure to get your career going as quickly as you can because, you know, it's the performance industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's still some cachet to being young and relatively cute.
Right.
Yeah. Well, especially I would say that there's almost a little bit of a gender divide there. For like, because
there's more than a bit of a gender divide in the opera world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because for women, it's like, get out there. And for men, it's like, well, you could probably wait till you're 35 if you really want to,
Yeah.
Those roles will still be there waiting for
right,
you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Come back. We miss you.
Yeah.
Go make some money. Go like, you know, plump up your savings account and then be Don Giovanni.
Yeah.
Be like a Silver Fox Don Giovanni. Whereas, like, heaven forbid, a Susanna have some gray.
Yeah, be over 28.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who would want to marry her? God, yeah. She's just falling apart.
She's like 30.
She's practically dead.
Yeah.
So you decided to pursue music.
I did, and I ultimately ended up in San Francisco, which was a crazy, half wonderful, half terrifying adventure. And I now have a newfound appreciation for burritos that I thought I had before, but it's just reached some like blasphemous levels.
Yeah.
Because of living in California for 2 years.
Holy shit.
Wow. I love burrito. I make a killer vegan breakfast burrito.
Yeah, you do. They're really good.
See that anyway. I can. Okay, fun fact about me: I hate eggs, so the only breakfast burritos that I eat are vegan.
That's interesting. I've talked to a couple people about because I like got a. I'm definitely an obsessive. I know we're gonna talk about mental health, so like I'm gonna graciously talk about my stuff first. It's like I get on a thing and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna master this thing, and I'm not gonna talk about anything else for a week, and I'm gonna figure it out. And so that's. How I was with tofu scramble. And it's funny because I then talked to most people that I knew about eggs and just like conceptually how eggs are. And I think there are a lot of people that fall into that camp of like, I don't like eggs.
I have met exactly one other person who doesn't like eggs. Everyone else calls me a weirdo and I'm not here for
but
it.
But there is a subset.
Tyler Lee also does not like eggs.
Yeah. And it's,
this is why we're friends. There's a deep cosmic connection.
I think people that don't like eggs don't talk about it, you know, because like
it's because they're pariahs.
Right.
There's a stigma. Jesus. Oh, we're gonna get
no. Yeah.
This is gonna come up later, friends. Just wait. Yeah.
No, I don't think that I think they're. I'm not saying I think they're pariahs.
They're social pariahs. Yeah.
Yeah, but like there is this, like if someone says they don't like eggs, they're like, well, then you haven't tried my eggs,
right? Or, you know. That is a very true thing. Is it is it texture for you?
Kind of texture and smell.
It's smell for Tyler. It is smell for Tyler because he eats them and he gets nauseous.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I, the thing that I really strive for with mine is using the diet cheddar, which I don't use for anything else, and Dijon, because that really mimics the, like, texture and consistency of yolk really well. Because it's like a vinegary, fatty game.
And but it doesn't taste out. Anything like eggs. You get like the salt pop, but you don't get like the like this came out of a chicken.
Yes. Right.
Which is yeah.
So anyway, that ends up in a breakfast burrito and it's aces with just some beans and that, like
beans and rice and tomatoes and some spinach. Besides that,
it's just simple, man.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's very good. Anyway.
Daniel's recipe corner has concluded.
I'm gonna start a recipe book, man. I think people will be in for it. Maybe or not.
Post it on the. Maybe it's an incentive to be a member.
Switchel, tofu scramble, vegan baked ziti.
Give them money. He'll make you switchel and breakfast burritos.
Yeah, dude. We'll talk later.
Yeah, we'll talk later.
Anyway, so you went to San Francisco, and talk to me because you went from kind of like a liberal arts campus in northern Wisconsin to San Francisco Conservatory in San Francisco.
Yes.
So, how was that adjustment?
The adjustment moving back to a city was very easy for me. That was one of my bigger environmental struggles in college, I guess, because I like having the energy of a city around me. I like having, even if I don't actually go out and do the thing, I like having the option to do the thing.
That's how
and
I feel too.
I really like Netflix and sitting around in my apartment as much as any other disaffected millennial, but if that's one of the only things there is to do when you're 21 and don't have a car, it gets pretty old.
Yeah. No,
we had fun, but I loved having The possibility of a city around me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that's really cool.
And so then you moved from there straight to Chicago?
Yes. After my first year, I realized that it was not going to be a financial option for me to stay in the city.
Cost of living after graduate, you're saying?
My first year of graduate school. Cost of living in SF had already surpassed Manhattan by that point.
Yeah.
Really?
San Francisco is crazy expensive. Well, because it's... Is that still where Silicon Valley is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley is like just to the south of the city.
Yeah.
My sister-in-law is currently interviewing for philosophy professor positions, and she got an interview at Stanford for an assistant professor position. Whoa. No, Kate, like, speaking of the episode of Shoutouts, like, my sister-in-law, Katie Smith, is one of the smartest goddamn people I have ever met. Mm-hmm. She's finishing up her doctorate at Cornell in philosophy, and, like, she will, oh, man, like, I want to just, like, put her in front of our microphone talk and just, like, let her
just be like,
and talk. We will say nothing. Just talk.
I love people that are that smart when you, like, you're talking about something and then they'll say something that's just so insightful.
Yeah.
And you have to go, like, sorry, I made a fade. Damn. Yeah. I don't know what the visual cues are today. But basically, the initial reaction of just, like, I never thought of that way before. Like, what? Like, just a mind,
yeah,
like the bomb going off, you know? Right. Like, cut to the mushroom cloud.
That's always so interesting to me because usually you have, as the listener, thought of it conceptually. It's just, you haven't found the words. You've just found the feeling. And when someone finds the words, it's just the most magical.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but so she...
Yeah, that is very true.
So she went to Palo Alto to interview at Stanford. And she, like, got information about, like, the logistics of living there. And there are financial assistance programs for housing for incoming faculty. Not students. Incoming faculty.
That does not surprise me.
There are financial assistance programs for housing.
I don't understand how, and maybe this is, as someone that's lived in San Francisco, maybe you can shed some light for this for me. I don't understand how people living there can't look at that and go, like, there is some systemic issue here. There is something that we need to, like, I don't know. Like, I'm not necessarily, like, regulations or go home, but, like, there's got to be, I don't know, like, maybe a regulation? Like, is that ridiculous of me to say? Like, that...
I think that...
There are pretty, I don't know if lenient is the right word, but there is some rent control in the city. If your building was built before, I believe it's 1970 or something, there are only a certain amount that your rent can go up. And mm-hmm. we lived in one of those buildings. It was pre-Great Earthquake.
Okay.
So one of the older buildings in the city. And we still paid for about 600 square feet. It was three people. We paid $2,800 a month. Mm-hmm. And that was considered affordable, especially in the neighborhood we were living in.
Is the city very dense?
Extremely dense. That's, I mean, for American cities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, no, I think that from my understanding of conceptually what will drive rent up quickly is density. And because that's why New York is the way that it is,
yeah.
Because it is so, there's so many people. And it's actually pretty spread out, but there's just so many people trying to live there it is a justifiable reason why rent goes up. But I was curious. I've never been to California. So, like,
so SF is situated on a peninsula, and it's commonly referred to as 7x7. So it measures 7x7 square miles. And the zoning regulations are the strictest of anywhere I've ever seen. So it's incredibly difficult to build high rises to get more units into the space. So you have more competition than you normally would because it's a smaller geographical area. You've got a ton of people trying to live there because they want to say, oh, I live in the city, when they have their new job at this tech startup or something like that. So competition is insane.
Yeah. Wow.
And so you get people who show up at the open house, they're like, here, I have cash for $500 more than the first month's rent is. Let me move into your apartment.
Right, because, like, dad funded it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, you had to leave San Francisco. You finished up your degree and then you left and you moved. First you went back to Milwaukee.
I did to look for jobs in Chicago, figure out what my next step was going to be. The original plan was to do everything by the book. Like, oh, you're done with grad school. Let's do Yaps now. And then I had a health problem. I had to get one of my ovaries removed because there was a giant cyst on it the size of a newborn baby. And really? That kind of, and that derailed everything, because when you're sitting at home for 6 weeks following major abdominal surgery, you can't really practice or go to auditions. Right. So you'll have to cancel all of your auditions for the next summer. And then you start thinking about life and the future. And oh, my friends, that's really fun.
Yeah, there is nothing that that sets up a mental health issue better than
a physical health issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is something that I'm working on being a lot more open about, because I think the more we talk about it, the better off we as a society are going to be.
Absolutely.
I've been taking antidepressants in various forms since I was 7 years old. Like, I just have wackadoo brain chemistry. It's mm-hmm. who I am as a person. And it was the first time that I'd ever had a major, major health problem. You know, there was talking with doctors, oh, is this cancerous? When will we finally know whether it's benign or not? And that puts a lot of stress on you. And combined with the major transition point of you're going into this incredibly competitive field, mm-hmm. you've just finished your education, you're trying to figure out how to turn this into an actual career path, that just completely paralyzed me and made me rethink a lot of things. And when you've just moved 2,000 miles and you're about to move again, it created a lot of uncertainty for me, which wasn't helping my mental state, because when you're stressed, your anxiety is, mm-hmm. and your anxiety symptoms are just going to go through the roof. That's how science works, I guess.
Right.
No, that rings true for me. When I moved to Chicago, I kind of had my first ever serious, like, mental health issues, and I ended up going to therapy for the first time, which was fantastic. And I think that everybody should go to therapy.
Shout out
major shout out to therapy. We talked a little bit about it with Lee Wichman, who's a therapist locally. He actually I think he specializes in performers
and also performers, couples, and LGBTQ.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think there's something to be said about what you're saying. I think there's something to be said about performers needing therapy, definitely. But I also think there's something to be said about people that move needing therapy for some reason, just because, like, it's a very fragile time. Like, it's hard to build relationships and communication in a community if it's not, you know, existent. And I think that although there is something to be said about networking and how easy it is in the classical singing community, that's not really... In some cases, it's not entirely the same as a emotional community, if that makes sense. Like a group of people that you can go, like, I woke up really depressed this morning and, like, wished that, you know, I wasn't alive or something. You know, like, that's, you don't really get to have that, like, intimate thing
with someone in your studio class.
With your voice teacher. Yeah.
I have got my theory about this is that there's a culture that's created among any kind of elite community. You're talking about athletes, scholars, performers, artists, is that when you're around your peers, you obviously want to impress them. And it mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily come from a place of malice or distrust. It comes from a place of not wanting to appear weak in front of your peers. And I read in an article around the time of the Olympics, that's my thing. one of my favorite swimmers is very open about her struggles with depression, and she did a major profile in ESPN about it. And in that article, there have been a bunch of studies done on mental illness in elite college level athletes, like D1 level. And it doesn't necessarily show higher rates, but they do show that they as a group are more reluctant to talk about it. And that mirrors my experiences in conservatory.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's so interesting. That's very interesting.
I also, like, revealing...
Podcast gold.
No, I'm, like, revealing the curtain, like, or the veneer. You have, like, extensive notes about, like, articles and stuff like that. And, which is awesome.
Well, it shows your poli-sci training, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I, as a person that, like, likes to claim that he has journalism experience, should have more notes, but I don't.
We have no notes. We talk about current events, and we have no notes, yeah. which results in me having to do, like, put correction posts on our Facebook posts. But, like, killing it. No, and I'm not trying to, like, I'm just, like, happy.
Social scientists are basically the meme of that conspiracy theorist guy with, like, all the strings behind him and the pictures.
Well, no. Sorry. I'm also just glad. I did not know that. I just am glad that's a thing, because, like, that is so... I love when you can actually say, here is a concrete fact. And I think, like, you need note-taking to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but I completely agree with you that, like, having also been in a conservatory setting, you know, it was a sign of weakness. Like, if someone had a mental breakdown, it was fodder for, like, cafeteria talk.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, did you hear that Stacy, like, totally freaked out in her lesson and, like, had to go home?
I heard she's taking a semester off. Oh, poor Stacy.
I know. Yeah. And like, it's this horrible toxic environment when, like, in reality, like, as people, as fellow humans, we should be like, did you hear about Stacy? Like, we should really do something for her, because that's really horrible.
Or even, did you hear about Stacy? Like, I maybe should do that.
Like, take a semester. Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Maybe, you know, I never thought, realized that the toxicity that I'm contributing to this environment may be because of my own mental health struggle. And, like, that, I think that not, I don't know. I don't really know how to, like, promote people trying to think about themselves. Because I personally feel that, like, when you get into a toxic environment like that, a lot of it is fueled by your, like, ego. Like, most everyone's ego. And it, when you get a bunch of people that just moved to a place and are trying to make it in a highly competitive field, and you stuff them together in a tight environment, and then you heighten competitiveness in the group, and one person does one thing, like, it's hard to... It's weird, because on the one hand, it's all fueled by, like, this, you know, difficulty with self. Like, you know, you're struggling with your own self-esteem and your own insecurities. But then you're contributing to the damage of other people's self-esteem and other people's psyche. And it's kind of like a really weird double-edged thing. I don't know. And I'm just keep thinking about, like, my thing where I remember multiple times, like, talking about going to therapy, and the people I went to school with are all great people. Like, after we've graduated, like, I'm friends with, I still talk to most of the people I went to school with, which I think is saying something. But I do remember that at the time, like, when I was in therapy, I didn't really talk to, there was 2 years I was in grad school, and I was in therapy for, like, for basically a semester. I was there consistently, and then I did it for a little bit in the next semester too. But I remember that in the, like, the brunt of it, which was, you know, the last 3 months of a semester, which was a really busy time. I think I was in an opera at the time that we were all in, and so it was, like, you know, rehearsal schedules and being around a ton of people. I didn't talk to anybody.
About your being in therapy?
No, I literally did not talk to anybody. Like, I was very isolated, and I didn't... And maybe part of that was my own thing, but I also think part of it was feelings of, you know, like... I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've also talked this about people with people too, but just, you know, feelings of not wanting to be like...
You don't want to be a burden to people, even though you know that they care about you and aren't going to judge you.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I had incredibly strong friend groups in both undergrad and grad school. And these are people that I tried to be very open about my struggles with them, and sometimes I was more successful at that than others, and they were always very supportive. But trying to work on those lines of communication doesn't translate to an institutional level necessarily. Mm-hmm. So the thing I'm interested in is cultivating a broader culture beyond like, oh, we'll have some part-time therapist that just tells you to sleep more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. Oh yeah, thanks. That's right. Super helpful.
Or the other side of it is I remember after I kind of dealt with my mate, and of course, like, I still need to go to therapy, but like after I dealt with my major things, I remember all of the professors being like, oh, it's so glad to see that you're feeling normal again. And I was like,
what? That's so
not
rude.
All the professors. I don't mean to say that. There are obviously fantastic professors at the school I went to, and I don't. But like, there were a couple situations where that happened, and I just remember thinking like, I don't know, because I feel like at the time that you could be going through major mental health things, and also have it be some of your most expressive art making time. You know, like, and I think that that's not necessarily like, I don't know. I think that. Like dignifying what is normal and what is unacceptable for performing and for study is not like it's all a fucking like I really respect the like liberal arts mindset, or even the you mentioned the elementary middle school that you went to that didn't have grades, and so I really respect this idea of like being able to take people at the place that they're at, but still be able to go like, you can still grow even though you're struggling. And so you don't necessarily, it's not necessarily measurable in the like conventional sense, but like your existence still matters. You know, like.
That was kind of the opposite experience for me, interestingly enough, yeah. Because I kind, as long as I can remember, I was always very achievement driven. So mm-hmm. I was obsessed with getting the best grades, getting the best roles, because if I felt so terrible all the time, the least I could do was be successful academically. And I think that was one of the biggest struggles I faced trying to go into singing professionally, because it's a whole different world. And I intellectually knew that once you finish school, and you're playing by a whole different set of rules, you're not actually going to understand how hard it is until you're experiencing it.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the weird beauty about mental health is that it's entirely unique.
It's very reactive for each person. You can develop strategies, but you never exactly know when you're going to run into a roadblock.
Yeah. Well, and it's also hard to like get started on your journey to like figuring that out. Like I remember when my background about me, my dad died when I was 21, and like days after it happened, my mom has a friend who is a therapist, and she, you know, approached my mom and was like, hey, if you or either of your kids want to talk about it, like, please, like, my office is open, like, please contact me about it. I want to, like, help as much as I can. And my mom told me that now, and like, a couple days, I was like, whatever, like, I'm fine. because, and I think it had to do with the profession I was pursuing, was like, I was like, I cannot lose focus. Like, I cannot let something as... And in that moment, where my head was at was, I'm not going to let something as insignificant as a parent dying deter me from my end goal. Which, like, I look at that now as, like, you know, someone who's out of school and someone who has left that path as, like, what the hell were you thinking? And it resulted, like, once I finished my undergrad, it resulted in me having, like, a complete mental breakdown, and, like, I had to move home because of my anxiety. And eventually I did seek therapy, and it helped so much. And if I had had, like, if there had been, like, the institutionalized support within my education of, like, listen, I understand that this career takes focus, but you need to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
I wasn't really given that. And it made a really horrible time so much worse. Mm. So I think that, like, having conversations of, like, you know, like, oh, there goes, you know, Maureen, Daniel, and Julia. They seem so level-headed, blah, blah, blah. Or maybe we don't. Maybe we seem like basket cases. But, like, you know, whatever. Like, but the fact is, these are all people who have gotten help. These are all people who have talked to someone about their shit. And, like, I think that being open about talking about how much that's helped is so important.
I also, this is a really errant thought and potentially tangential, but I also always get a little weirded out when people talk about how their voice teacher is their therapist. Do you know what I mean by that? Where it's like, yeah. Oh, I don't need to go to therapy. I have a voice teacher. And it's like, that's not, like, the person you're going for voice lessons from, although is albeit a great person, doesn't have psych training. Maybe they took a psych 101 class in their undergrad 20 years ago. But, like, then what? They're just going to, like, potentially classify you, and, like, that's your what you're going to.
There's a DSM sitting on the piano.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of mental health, the most helpful thing that a voice teacher has told me has been like, you know, I think that tonight you should go home and put your feet up and have a glass of wine and, you know, watch something and listen to some relax. But that's not legitimate mental health advice. I mean, that's good life advice for if you're feeling overwhelmed.
That's a self-care tip that may work
exactly
today.
And so, like, that's like the voice teacher's A game of, like, mental health advice.
Yeah.
Where, like, if you're really feeling lost or, you know, hopeless, like you need more than putting your feet up. You need to have, like, real conversations, and you need to unpack some shit, and
a real voice teacher is gonna know that anyway. They're obviously gonna want to be a mentor and an advocate for you, but it also means not overstepping that boundary. Mm-hmm. Or trying to, I don't want to say fix is the wrong word, but
right. Well, and also if I'm a voice teacher and someone is coming to me with their mental health issues, the first thing I'm going to say is, listen, I am not a therapist. I am not a mental health professional. I am a voice teacher. If you have tongue tension, let's talk about that. But I mean, like, if you're feeling the way I think you're feeling, like, I'm not your guy.
Yeah. This is not my bag.
Like, I love you. I support you. I want you to be happy and healthy. But, like, my word is not, like, my expertise is not in making you feel more stable.
Yeah.
So, like, please get help. And I think that any voice teacher would agree that, like, anyone saying that their voice teacher is their therapist, they're like, oh, no. I am your voice teacher.
Yeah. So, I want to talk a little bit more about your experience. So, you came back to Chicago, and you already mentioned that you kind of, like, started looking at Yap stuff. Did you end up coming back to trying to do it, and then thinking kind of your next step, or how did that look?
It was kind of a go through the motions, take what comes along and see what happens. The first thing that I did right after I moved is I auditioned for Lyric Opera Chorus. And, mm-hmm. you know, I went into it knowing you haven't performed for anyone in 9 months.
Mm.
This isn't going to be a showstopper audition. You're just doing this to get your feet wet, get comfortable with this again. And I was honestly totally fine with that, because I knew to rev my engine, get myself going again, I had to start going through the basic steps of treating every audition like just another job interview, not this thing that's going to make or break your life. And I did that. I started going out on every local audition I could find, and I found that I was being more anxious and terrified of them than I had ever been in my life, and I could not put my finger on why, because I'm one of those assholes who went through her entire academic career never getting stage fright once. And so it was very disorienting to me, and it made me stop, and it made me think a lot. Why am I doing this? Why do I have the yips? And, you know, I went to, and I started taking lessons, and we talked about it a little bit. Shout out to Tim Filliman out in the Western suburbs. He is a great, great pedagogue. He had some sports psychology suggestions for me to look into. And the more I thought about it, I thought maybe these yips, they're a sign. I should really start thinking about whether the traditional you have to do the yaps before you start to work at this company, before you start to work at this company. And I realized that this thing I told myself for my entire life, since I was 15 years old, that this is what I wanted, I did not want that anymore. Mm. And that was scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and then I remember, like, you know, since you moved to Chicago, like, I've been kind of like, because I remember when I first moved to Chicago, like, I always really liked it when the people I already knew here would, like, kind of check in on me. And so, like, whenever I've had a friend move to Chicago, I always make a point of being like, hey, how's it going? Hey, how's it going? So I was doing that with you. And I remember after election night.
Yeah.
You were like, I have news.
Yes. So, in, like, around Labor Day, I had a... Actually, let's go all the way back to 2015.
Okay.
I was in the middle of doing the gig of my life. I was performing in a production of Elixir of Love at the Kennedy Center with some people from school. And we got to go to to Washington for a weekend, obviously. And the whole time I was there, Hillary had just announced that she was running again. I was like, oh, yeah, it's election season. This is like Christmas for me. Ha. And I realized I missed this thing in my life, and I was having this identity crisis in the middle of doing this incredibly amazing performing opportunity. And I was in the plane on the way back, and I found myself feeling so despondent, and I was like, it's too late to change course. Everyone who has been working in politics has been doing this since they were, you know, since they were 18 and interning or volunteering. And I was really sad about it, but I thought, you know, I've made my choice. I have committed to being a singer. I am going to move on. I'm going to graduate.
Yeah.
I'm going to see where it goes. Fast forward to past a nervous breakdown. I'm in Chicago. The lifestyle is not working out for me. It is making me exceedingly unhappy, only exacerbating my symptoms. And I think, you know, maybe I'll look at arts admin. That seems like something I would enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, at the same time, I majored in political science. It's a huge passion for me. Especially winning elections is a huge passion for me. And so in the midst of 2016, I was definitely paying attention.
Yeah.
And then I definitely have started calling everything my post-11-9 life.
Yeah.
As after, you know, fairly, I would say, one of the most dramatic nights of my life, where I had some very ugly emotional reactions that, you know, we could get into another time.
Yeah.
It was a wake-up call. I woke up that morning, and I thought, this is it. I have to get on the front lines. I have to find some way to fight back against this new world that we've all woken up in. And I have the training, yeah, at least the academic training, at least. I don't have any field experience or anything like that. But it's time to move. It's time to do something. Because if not living up to the ideal of the perfect opera singer that you have in your head is making you miserable and making you unable to enjoy life, move forward with your life, have any kind of ambition, you need to make a change, and you need to make it now.
Mm-hmm.
And your country needs you.
Cool. Speaking of, so I actually, I want to talk about one current events thing, if that's cool. And I know this is like a sharp segue, but I'm prefacing about it, so I feel less bad about it. which is my weird game of making things okay. But anyway, so the thing that I really want to talk about is I listen to this podcast called Radio Dispatch. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's like a leftist podcast, but they were talking about 45's new budget. And there's something on it that I want to talk about because I don't think it's getting enough coverage, and I just want to mention it and we can move on. But they were talking about, of course, there's the part that everybody's talking about, which is Meals on Wheels, that they're cutting, that they want to cut Meals on Wheels. But they also want to cut after school program, like before and after school programming, which, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is because it is like an important thing. It's something that one of the co-hosts, Molly Neffel, is really an advocate for. She's also a teacher. And I just think it's something that, like, we should be talking more about, or at least be aware of, because, like, it goes actively against the idea of Trump being a jobs president, because, like, the people that need after-school and before-school help with their children are hardworking Americans that are working, that can't pick up their kids at a traditional hour, and the idea of cutting a program like that that isn't entirely, like, ridiculously budget-intensive, especially if you're comparing it to, like, trying to build a wall, or I'm not going to get into the extremes of what we're justifying cutting Meals and Wheels and after-school and before-school budgetary spending to
flying to Florida every weekend.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous. But, like, the conceptually, the thing, fact of the matter is, I think that there is something to trying to find a positive in that. Like, talking about what after-school specials do is really important. Like, when I was in elementary school...
You mean after-school programs now?
Right. Yeah. After-school specials. Like,
Billy, what did we learn about coconut?
Right. You know, when I was in elementary school, there was a period of time... I mean, elementary school, high school, there was a period of time when my parents couldn't afford their... They were, like, classic... victims of, like, the housing crisis and all that stuff. So they had a really hard time affording their bills, and my mom had to, you know, take on a couple of jobs for a little while. And there was a time where I was in after-school programs, and, you know, obviously I don't think that my white privileged lifestyle is the, like, epitome of after-school programming, but I could only imagine, like, not I can't imagine, but, like, the fact of the matter is the people that are going to be really screwed over are brown Americans and people of color, and, like, it's just terrible. And it, yeah, and I just want, that's all I really wanted to say. And I'm sorry that I, like, segued into all of this, but because I know that you are very passionate about poli-sci, so, like, I just wanted to shoehorn in current events, and I'm sorry.
So the thing that's jumping out to me about this is it's this weird idea of your family, the issues that your family faces on a daily basis, you know, for the kids that, and the parents that really benefit from having a place where their children can safely be after school to, mm-hmm. you know, do their homework, hang out with their friends, that kind of thing. That family doesn't fit what we, the Republican Party,
yeah.
thinks a family should look like. So we're just going to pretend that you don't exist mm-hmm. and that these issues don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just kind of like variations on a theme of like hitting marginalized populations, like working mothers and,
right.
you know, the LGBTQ community. Because I think that, you know, the Republican Party's mindset in specifically 45's mindset of like cutting after school programs is like, well, like, when you really think about, like, where he's coming from is, well, women shouldn't be working anyway. So they, like women should be able to pick their kids up from school. So, yeah. And, you know, if you were to call him on that, he would never say it. But, like, what other reason would he have for wanting to trim the, quote, trim the fat there?
Yeah, and I also think it's interesting coming from an artistic background, because in a lot of cases in public education, a lot of the after school program is where public education pushes its art programs and pushes its music programs, because it's like, well, we have after school programming, so, like, we don't need to do like the majority of our budget on those issues. We'll just put them in after school programming and then we'll use that budget for it.
The school day is for test prep.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think it is very important to talk about that. And of course, like Meals and Wheels is also important and also extremely like contradictory to
rhetoric. Like, but we could do an entire episode
it's just emblematic of the disconnect. Well, it's a disconnect in empathy, really. It's, you know, if you didn't experience something in your childhood, which, you know, like Donald Trump did not need. After school programming.
Yeah. Because he had a fleet of nannies, I imagine.
And that's not inherently bad, but what I think is inherently bad is being unable to take a moment and think, what might this person's experience be like? Why might this policy allow them to have... Yeah. I don't know. I'm getting all worked up about it. I obviously need more media training.
No, you're great.
Fine. So I actually want to segue back into kind of the arc of your life thing.
And also, where your expertise in poli-sci lies.
Yeah, well, and I want to ask you, so what, now that you've kind of are coming out of this, like, transitory period.
This, like, aha moment.
Yeah, like, what are your new goals? Like, what are some things that you've kept that you're kind of like when you're playing the, I don't know how often you play the, like, what is 5 years from now going to look like game? I play that game a lot. How has that changed? What's stayed the same?
The big number for me right now is 2018. Right now, winning is what matters to me. I think the GOP has been a master of the long game.
Yeah.
Been more consistently a master of the long game than the Democratic Party has. And I think we're starting to be on the right track again with the 50-state strategy. And being from Wisconsin, focusing on state legislatures and governorships is a very big deal for me. Not only driving up participation in state and local elections, but also because if something is so entrenched at every single level of government, it starts to seem with every year that passes like an impossible juggernaut to overcome. And I think we need to keep up this massive energy that we've been, you know, seeing in our liberal circles.
Yeah.
And so getting people to care about state and local elections is a very big passion of mine. And also getting people to realize how much harder it is across the country for people to vote.
Yeah.
That is so important. Voter suppression is a huge issue. And it's an issue that I think the right and the Republican Party has taken into their lockstep mantra. I like think about this a lot, where the Republican Party is so quick to be like, here's an issue we should all agree on. And if you don't agree on this, you don't agree with the Republican Party. And it is...
Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. And I think voter suppression is a big deal. And I think a lot of these states, what you're talking about, that are state legislature important kind of states, Wisconsin.
Shout out to Wisconsin.
North Carolina.
Shout out to North Carolina.
There's another one, but I can't think it off the top of my head right now. But are falling victim to these legislatures that, you know, you're talking about thousands of votes for people that are citizens, but... you know, they don't have the income to make sure that they have the proper ID or something like that. And, you know, voter fraud is not as the proportion of voter fraud in Trump's cabinet does not reflect the American population. Like, it's not voter suppression is a big deal. And it's something that people don't talk about for some reason, and I don't really know why that is. And I know that Maureen mentioned that, and you also obviously just mentioned that that's something that is really important to you. You know, I think that that's amazing. And I, what made you, like, what brought you to that?
I think just because So I started becoming interested in elections because of the drama of it all. I was able to tie that into my artistic background.
Yeah.
And it's these very high stakes, but ultimately very human stories that are being played out in real time. And the more time I spent thinking about elections and the nature of democracy, that's the most fundamental thing, is being able to have a voice and having a say in who makes your policy and who shapes the structures in the place that you are living.
Mm-hmm.
And just with so many people starting to be aware again of the rise of authoritarianism all around the world, not just here. I mean, like, look at what the Europeans are dealing with. Mm-hmm.
France right now.
Oh, poor France.
Well, and there was something, who just voted?
The Netherlands.
Yes. And that actually wasn't as bad, but there apparently were a couple authoritarian people that got smaller offices, but the major election went to the Green Left, apparently. Yes. Which was really exciting.
Which, thank God.
Yeah.
At least someone figured it out.
Yeah.
I was definitely watching that one.
Yeah, well, because I think a lot of people that are trying to pay attention to the world scale are really keeping an eye on France right now. Mm-hmm. And keep trying to keep an eye on Europe, because, you know, it's hard to not recognize that this like isolationist authoritarian ideals and mindsets really kicked off with Brexit. And, you know, and then it was Trump, and now we're just kind of like, okay, who's the alliances, who's the axis, you know, like,
yeah.
It's a weird time we're in right now.
Well, it's all kind of a reaction to kind of post-industrial globalization. These far-right nationalists have been incubating in Europe, you know, post-World War II for quite some time, because, you know, ideologies are incredibly difficult to kill. They're going to incubate and they're going to slightly reform. And I think people get so complacent. There's a book called It Can't Happen Here that my friend got for me a couple years ago, because she knows I read too much dystopia. And it always can happen here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because our institutions are only as strong as the people that are functioning in them. And we have to defend our democratic ideals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And for me, the best way to do that is to advocate for free and fair elections.
Cool. Yeah, because that's the whole point of democracy.
Yeah.
And you know? you mentioned how voter suppression has been a bedrock of the Republican Party's strategy for so long. I want to do some recommended reading.
That I was literally just going to ask, like, what is something that we can do to, you know.
So I'm about halfway through this book. It's called Give Us the Ballot, and it's by Ari Berman, and it's a history of voter suppression in America post-1965, the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And it shows the reactionary steps that, you know, it starts out mostly as, you know, the segregationist faction in the South during the Civil Rights era, how they tried to make voter suppression seem colorblind and more respectable. And then as the book goes on, it shows how the Southern strategy turns into voter ID laws and, you know, not Mississippi, but places like Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a really depressing book, and it follows the careers of people like John Roberts. Like, you learn what he was up to during the Reagan administration, and you're like, wow, I didn't learn that in current events class when I was 15 years old, talking about the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, I was, someone mentioned all the Jeff Sessions marijuana stuff recently, and I was like, guys, did we forget about the Nixon administrator that was like, yeah, we pretty much were cracking down so hard on drugs because the blacks and the liberals liked it, and like, it's the same goddamn playbook.
Yep.
Like, it's not new. Like,
I'm a firm believer in know your enemy, and yes, I am dramatic enough that I say know your enemy.
Yeah.
But that's part of the reason I like this book, is you understand what their strategies and their thought process are, because if you don't understand that, you can't think up a way to fight back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so towards the end of every episode, what we always do is we kind of give a plug for things that obviously I think is part of it. But I also want to... is there a place that people can keep up with what you're up to, what you're working on?
You should follow me on Twitter.
Great.
It's at Jules Persists because I am a trendy asshole.
Yeah.
Good.
And also, who loves saying mean things about Mitch McConnell on the daily. I complain about Paul Ryan a lot. I retweet a lot of interesting journalists. And
nice.
I'm a big fan of really long Twitter threads that just go on and on about context, which I know isn't really what the platform is used to, but I think context and facts still matter.
Yeah.
Even in the era of the 24-hour news cycle.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
Nice.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we're up to, you can do that in a few different places. The first and our favorite is over at the website, scopymag.com. Feel free to go ahead and bookmark that if you want to. You know, we update it occasionally. There, we're looking like over the next couple weeks, there will probably be some more articles up. There is an archive of older articles of really interesting stuff. You can also check us out on Facebook under Scopy Magazine. You can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Scopy Mag. On Twitter, you can get an update whenever we post a new episode. And if actually on Twitter, you'll get that update before we post it to Facebook because that links directly to our podcast feed. And on Instagram, we post pictures of events and cats and, you know, general what to do.
Also, if you want to follow us individually on Instagram.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I'm at That's Amore. Amore spelled A-M-A-U-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there's like weird feedback.
Yeah, there's weird buzz. and I'm at Summertime Sweater. At Summertime Sweater.
Yeah, so I want to emphasize the importance of donations. You can head to our website, scopymag.com, and go to our About section, and you can become a monthly subscriber or do a one-time donation. We've actually just updated our subscriber levels. So it used to be like $5 a month, $25 a month, but what we did... Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure out if there's like a cord on top of another cord or something. Sorry.
I'm so distracted.
You're so distracted. Okay, I think you're good.
Okay, cool. It used to be $5 a month, $25 a month, and then like $100 a month. But we've updated it so that it's like $5 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month, $40 a month. Like, so there's a little more leeway. So if you want to give more than $5, but $25 is a little bit too steep, you can give $10. If you want to give more than $25, but $100 is too steep, you can give $40. Like we're offering some middle ground there. And you know, we, like I've said, we run on a $0 budget, as evidenced by the fact that I was so distracted by that audio weirdness. I'd love to update our audio setup so that I can get through a damn sentence without crackling in my ears. And if you want to hear more conversations like the one we just had, we need your support. So head to Scopy Mag, give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, then just listen, participate, and share.
Thanks again so much for listening, and go out and make something.
Yep. And make some noise.